This is Visionary, a show exploring how nuclear powers your world. I'm Mary Carpenter.
And I'm Jordan Houghton. Let's jump in.
Hey, Jordan.
Hey, Mary. And hello, Visionaries.
Hey, Visionaries. Thanks for joining us today. I think you're going to love this conversation. It might be the favorite topic we've covered so far on my end.
It's really, really different from anything else we've covered. Very excited to talk to James Larkin, who is with the RICEtope Project, which is combining isotopes and rhinos.
Yeah, it's very cool. So the RICEtope Project is focused on stopping rhino poaching. And there's been a lot of different ideas to try and curb rhino poaching, which we all know is such a serious issue. And James will go into a bit more and share just how serious it is in the episode. But different ideas have come up over the years. Some people have thought about putting color into the rhino horns to make them unattractive for poachers. I know when I worked on Capitol Hill, people would try and get funding for, you know, more equipment for rangers to go out, you know, middle of the night, night vision goggles, things like that to help. But, you know, this is a new idea that they have. So they want to inject radioisotopes into rhino horns, and that will deter the poachers from wanting the horns. And such a great idea. And, you know, an interesting new way for nuclear to help with conservation efforts.
I was absolutely fascinated to learn about the RICEtope Project. Was not anywhere on my radar. And I think our listeners are really going to be blown away. He has a international effort in progress. He's working with academics, universities, and people all around the globe on this. And it is just so interesting to see how many people have come together to help protect rhinos. Okay, so I've never visited Africa, but Mary, I know you have, and you had a really incredible experience there.
Yeah, so we went to Kenya 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago now, and I've always loved rhinos, and I really wanted to see a rhino, but you know, they're very rare in Africa. In the part of Kenya that we were in, we were looking for black rhinos. And, you know, every kind of camp you go to, they're like, don't get your hopes up. There's only 5,000 black rhinos left in the whole world. So they're hard to spot. And, you know, they're kind of shy. They don't really like coming around if there's cars around and things like that. So don't get your hopes up. And the second camp we went to, on the very first day, we were out driving and our guide was like, oh my gosh, I think that's a rhino. And I was like panicking. And we get a little closer and we get a little closer. And then all of a sudden this rhino just like is walking so slow, just eating some grass. We were the only people around. It was just us and just me, my husband, and our guide. And I like look up and I see him and the rhino is just very calm. And we sat there for probably an hour just watching this rhino. I seriously cried. It was the coolest thing. I didn't know if we were going to get to see one. But, you know, it's just the animal is so big and beautiful. And it's just like honestly breathtaking to see it in the wild and just to know how lucky we were to see one, because a lot of people don't. Was really cool. And then we actually saw two more on that trip, which was absolutely insane. Yeah. So we saw three rhinos total, which was, we felt so lucky. And if you guys haven't had a chance to go on a safari, highly recommend going. And, you know, it's more than you can put into words. It's breathtaking to see these creatures in the wild in their natural habitats. And it's something I think everyone should try and do, because it really changes your perspective on how important it is to protect them and their environment. And you can't describe it unless you see it in person. It's really cool.
Absolutely amazing. I got chills while you were telling that story. I think it's a great way to jump into our interview with James.
So today we're honored to have Professor James Larkin with us. With a deep commitment to nuclear security education, Professor Larkin has shared his expertise globally, including as a past chairman of the International Atomic Energy Agency's International Nuclear Security Education Network. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Medicine in the UK, a member of the Institute for Nuclear Materials Management in the US, and a founding member of the South African Radiation Protection Association. Currently, James is spearheading the RICEtope Project, an organization using the power of radioisotopes to help save the rhinos. James, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
It's only my pleasure in listening to that introduction. I don't hardly recognize myself, but thank you very much. Well, someone's been doing their homework.
Well, we gave like a little bit of an overview, but we want to hear from you. Tell our listeners a little bit about your background and your career and how you got to where you are today.
So I was born in Kenya many, many years ago now. And then my family bounced backwards and forwards because my father was a veterinary surgeon. When he graduated from veterinary college in the UK, he moved to East Africa, to Kenya, to go and be a meat inspector to start off with. At about a similar sort of time, my mother left the, well, no, she continued to be employed by MI5 and then moved to South Africa, to East Africa and Kenya. And when my parents married, she joined Special Branch. So we have two very varying backgrounds. And I was born in Kenya. Then we went back to the UK when I was about the age of one, and then went back to Kenya when I was about the age of eight. So I have very rose-tinted memories of living in Kenya, you know, going to places like the Maasai Mara Game Reserve and camping there, and going to Tsavo National Park and to treetops, all of these, some of these iconic tourist destinations that people have heard about. And then in 1974, moved back to the UK and continue my education in the UK. I went to university to sort of round out my education, and I spent much of my time either on the rugby pitch or on the canal rowing rather than doing academic studies. And I came out with a moderate qualification in cell biology and then worked for myself for about 10 years. In 1995, I was asked if I wanted to come out to South Africa to come and work for a friend of my father, and working for a gentleman by the name of John Constantine. And he had a radiation protection business, and he wanted someone with some practical skills working with heavy machinery, but a sort of science background. And so he asked me if I wanted to come out, and I was only supposed to come out to South Africa for a couple of months and then go back to the UK, but somehow I forgot to go home. And from there, I was offered the opportunity to go and run a course in radiation protection at Wits University, because we never call it the University of Witwatersrand, because not even I can pronounce it properly. And so there, I started working there in 1999 and ran various courses, particularly the course in radiation protection. And had you asked me 5 years ago, where do I see myself in 5 or 10 years' time, it certainly wouldn't have been working on trying to conserve and prevent poaching of rhino eventually. So I'm, you know, quietly working along, and this was prior to COVID, doing a lot of international travel to these different countries, very different cultures, and going there to go and take part in some sort of educational process. And then COVID came along. And so all of that traveling came to a very shuddering halt, because here in South Africa, we had quite an extreme lockdown, certainly for the first couple of weeks. And so that very much gave me some time to sort of look at the walls and scratch my head, and then, you know, having start think about this project. It came about because, and around about 2019, I met two women who had a project going where they were injecting dyes and poison into the horn of the rhino. And they wanted to know, would it be possible to put radioactivity in it? I said, no, because I'm quite keen to stay out of prison. I don't look good in orange. And so from there, so I, you know, sort of said no, but it did, you know, then plant the seeds of an idea in my mind, because I understood, you know, I suppose, having the knowledge about sort of what efforts globally have been done in nuclear security and what's been done to prevent nuclear terrorism, I realized that there's something like 11,000 installed radiation monitors around the world. And I thought, well, maybe if we could find the right level of activity that wouldn't harm the animal, but could set off a sensor at a port or a harbour or something like that, we might be onto something, because at the same time, you know, 99% of the world is very scared, or at least misunderstands what radiation is. So that was my thought. Well, if we make something slightly radioactive, then people don't really want it. Because when you look at the backgrounds to the demand for horn, research has shown that it's, contrary to much Western popular belief, it's not as an aphrodisiac, nor actually is the biggest demand in traditional, you know, Chinese or Vietnamese medicine, but it's nowadays to give the horn, either carved or whole, as a gift to engender favor with your business colleagues, or to display on the mantelpiece in your house your fabulous wealth, because horn is worth up to about $60,000 per kilogram. So, and a horn can weigh 1, 2, maybe in certain circumstances, 3 kilograms in weight. So you can do the mathematics and realize how valuable in the eyes of some people the rhinoceros horn is. It, you know, exceeds the value of things like cocaine or gold or platinum, those sorts of things. But really, in, you know, the real world, has no value. The only thing that has value, you know, the only thing that needs a horn is a rhino, and it's only the rhino who really should value the horn that's on the end of their snout. So I kind of placed myself at the middle of this web, and I've sort of shot out emails to all around the world, to colleagues I've met through mostly the nuclear security work that I've done. And many of those people also have a background in radiation protection like myself. And so we could start talking and say, you know, what about this idea? And so I ended up talking to a friend and colleague, a guy called Tom Johnson in Colorado State. And he, with his students at Colorado State, have a close working relationship with universities in Japan, where they've done research work looking at the effects of radiation on the wildlife around Fukushima. And, you know, got to talking and said, hey, Tom, what do you think about this idea? And to my kind of surprise, he didn't turn around and say, oh, God, that's a terrible idea. But he said, you know, this is something really rather interesting. You know, let's try and move it on. So that gave me the start of the impetus, I suppose, around about 2020, something like that. And, you know, from there, we've incrementally had to examine different ideas, look at various things as we're moving the whole idea forward, until, you know, 2 weeks ago, we were able to go to the US and finally test some, you know, fake horn in real life detector systems. We work with the Customs and Border Protection people.
That's amazing.
It's been fantastic. And, you know, the team that have brought themselves towards me, I think, is almost the right way to do it.
So where do you get the isotopes?
We make them ourselves. We import the appropriate compounds and we take them to the reactor. We got another colleague who did the very detailed calculations how long we needed to put it into the reactor, because that's a science in and of itself. You know, quite willingly sort of did a very detailed calculation, set of calculations, but it was like a 10-page report. And it was just like, you know, here, I've done it for you. And so we knew what we needed to put into the reactor, and they made it, and we've been able to then utilize this in putting it into the rhino horn. And likewise, our colleagues at the rhino orphanage, my, you know, COO of the project, Jess Babbage, has been cultivating them for a while and talking to them. She had to learn sort of nuclear science to start off with, because she's got, you know, a background in anthropology, human anthropology, and has been this kind of ideal partner in this project. And speaking to these people, because she's got a long and very well-respected background in conservation.
Where's the rhino orphanage?
It's in an area called Limpopo.
Okay.
Which is sort of the northern part of South Africa. And eventually the gentleman who runs it, Arif and Devante, was sort of almost knocking on the door saying, when are you going to start? When are you going to start? And I said, calm down. We've got to allow us to finish doing, the important part of the research about, doses and what quantities we're going to put into it. And so, again, we haven't had to twist any arms or anything like that. The cooperation has been willingly given. And, it's been fantastic to be able to, work with these sorts of people. And this whole thing is, obviously first do no harm to the animals. And so you'd do the basic calculations and then you'd do some very detailed computer modeling. But until you get to see it in life, like Kennedy Airport, hearing for the first time the alarm going off as the truck drove through the detectors, and we had it at the right sort of activities. It was a realistic setup, hearing that alarm going off, that very physical demonstration of the maths and physics that you've done made it so very real.
So can I ask in that, so the premise of the RiceOtope project is using radioisotopes and inserting them into the rhino horns. And I know you had mentioned some other folks had looked at dyeing rhino horns, kind of adding color to make them less appealing. If you're using the radioisotopes, can the poachers see it and understand that it's, not just a pure horn, or is it more for the latter tracking it once it's been poached?
The project works, and the idea works on about three different levels. First and foremost, it's to devalue rhino horn in the eyes of the end users. So we know from research that is done by various people that the target audience are the people who want, rhino horn to be able to sort of put it into their whiskey or to demonstrate their fabulous wealth are basically gentlemen of 40 or 50 years old, that sort of range, probably better educated than much of the population of China and Vietnam. These are the people who've made significant wealth for themselves and are aware of Fukushima, Chernobyl, things like that, or the whole sort of what we would call radiophobia, something, they will have that. They don't understand what radiation is, what its effects are. And there's a lot of research shows that people will radically overestimate the harm any particular dose will do to them. So they're not going to go and hunt the animals, because rhino poaching, particularly ivory poaching to some extent as well, is organized by criminal syndicates. They put the kind of the kingpin, the middleman, will put together a poaching team. You'll have the shooter, you'll have the logistics guy, and the guy we call the axe man. So they will go out into the park or go poaching for between 1 and 3 weeks. They're out to just make money any way they can. So we devalue the horn in the eyes of the end users. Secondly, then, if an animal's horn is taken, and this is kind of a bittersweet situation for me, because obviously we don't want the animal to be poached in the first case. But if the horn is taken, then we get that second bite at the cherry to be able to, the animal's death hasn't been completely in vain. We are now putting the smuggling routes under threat of detection, because we've shown that it's now significantly easier to detect horn as it's moved along the chain from Southern Africa to the Far East, because even if it's smuggled out of Southern Africa through Mombasa, Mozambique, through the DRC, it will still either go into a container, it will go into an airline suitcase or something like that. And if the detectors aren't working at one point, say in South Africa or Mozambique, they can be working in Malaysia, in Singapore, in Abu Dhabi, in Dubai, Qatar, places like that. All of these places have newer systems than the fact that the ones that we tested at JFK. So that means that that's the second point we push back on the whole poaching chain. And the third point is that we have a philanthropic and educational aspect to the whole project. So we will engage with local populations around game farms. Particularly, we work with young women and schoolgirls because it's the women who, you know, are the backbone of the family.
So you did the testing, and I'm curious now what's next, but I'm also curious when you think you might actually be able to try it in a live rhino.
Well, we've already started our pilot project. So 20 rhino, live rhino, are now radioactive, if you want. They have radioisotopes inserted into their horns, and this is at the Limpopo Rhino Orphanage. We are following those now until the end of December. So it's a sort of 6-month period where we're looking to see if there's changes in behavior, changes in horn growth, or anything like that. We don't predict that there will be from the modeling that we've done. At the beginning of next year, we'll dart about 10 of those 20 animals. We'll take blood samples. We'll take other measurements as well, look at the sort of the gross well-being, do a visual inspection, a close visual inspection of the horn and things like that. And after that, provided nothing should prove untoward in the blood tests or anything else, we are then, if you like, open for business. We will then happily engage with stakeholders in the, you know, the health and welfare, who people who want us to use this system on their animals. So we'll start early, you know, starting early next year.
Who decides what rhinos would participate?
Many of the rhinos in South Africa are actually in privately owned private hands.
Oh, interesting.
Unlike the rest of Africa. And in fact, now in South Africa, there's probably more rhino in private hands than there are in national parks, which for us is quite a good thing, is because then we can quietly chip away, if you like. We can work with one rhino owner and do their animals or do the percentage of their animals and then just quietly move on. You know, see, government organizations are always that bit more loath to commit to something like this, which is obviously a, you know, very radical departure from what they're used to at the moment. The whole idea is we want to be able to, by treating a percentage of the number of animals on a farm, it's going to get to the point where the poachers say it's just not worth our while to even go on to that farm because we don't know how many of the animals have been treated. If they've taken the horn, they're going to get rid of it and it's going to go into the smuggling routes, which is, to my mind, is, you know, then puts those smuggling routes at threat. And the research has shown, the results have shown, and the findings have shown that, you know, if there's rhino horn in a container, a sort of shipping container, there's almost always other illicit wildlife trafficking goods, other illicit goods there as well, all of which then are put at risk because, you know, if a detector goes off at a port or a harbour or something like that, the whole container is moved to one side for what they call a secondary inspection, which generally means breaking the seal, the customs guys opening up and actually having a darn good rummage around inside to see what set off their radiation detector. And, you know, they will then, if they're opening up a container and they find a rhino horn, then they're going to start looking rather closely at the rest of the contents of that suitcase or cargo or container.
What is your plan, or do you have one yet, for how you're going to spread the word and make it so poachers know that there are isotopes in rhino horns?
Welcome to our plan. You're part of it.
Happy to help.
It's a continual engagement with social media, with the press. You know, the power of social media nowadays is just growing and growing. But, you know, you journalists are honorary members of the Rhizotope team, because that's how we're going to do it. It has to be working with well-placed individual, you know, journalists who we need to cultivate, we need to talk to, we need to explain to them how the system works, what it is, what we're trying to do. And, you know, from the launch this time around, you have seen, you know, any number of publications in, you know, various different languages. Even I know it's got to the Taipei News, but it's just that growing process of engaging with people who want to hear our story, I suppose, is how we do it.
You mentioned governments. I'm curious, is the South African government interested in this project, and are other African countries interested?
Yeah, look, we haven't spoken much to the, you know, South African government. We've not had a formal discussion with them yet. That will come in the good fullness of time. Because of the years I spent in radiation protection education at the university, I've been quite privileged to sort of educate and at least talk to a number of the different senior members of various different regulatory authorities that's through much of Africa. So, because South Africa is a place where a lot of African students will come to do appropriate technical and scientific education. And so it's been my privilege to be able to work with some of these. And I know some of these people are following us on LinkedIn and places like that, and just quietly watching to see what's going on, you know, places from Botswana, from Namibia, Zambia, all places where we, hopefully in the near future, we'll be able to go and do some work to be able to, work on the populations of rhinos that are held there.
Do you see this being able to be used in other endangered species?
Yes, and we are kind of warming up that discussion on a number of different fronts. Had some very fruitful discussions with colleagues in the Netherlands to look at how we can devalue elephant ivory. I'm in the process of trying to find a way to get a pangolin carcass to Australia to do some ultra-high resolution scanning at the Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organization. They have a synchrotron there, which is one of the two in the world, which is set up to do ultra-high level, high-resolution scanning. If you think of, a CT scan, but do it at 10 times the resolution. So you get like 10 times the information. And more recently, had some very interesting discussions with one of the Brazilian government research organizations. They would like to sort of participate and find ways to look at things like toucans and Amazon alligators. And then kind of somewhere down the line, we want to be able to look at things that plants called cycads, which are prehistoric type plants, which are around in the dinosaur times and still exist, but for reasons best known to collectors, all of a sudden have become very desirable for collectors to own. And so we're seeing them being sort of ripped out of the ground in various different parts of the bushveld here and, traded to unscrupulous gardeners. Wouldn't have thought that gardeners of that could be described at that sort, but there are, people who are prepared to pay tens of thousands of dollars to own a specimen of a plant that's, almost prehistoric. On elephants and other species, obviously there are a number of behavioral and anatomical and physiological issues that we need to consider very carefully to see whether it's a practical solution. You get to understand that these are really quite special animals. And, if you take rhinos out, you take elephants out of an ecosystem, you will see extraordinary and profound changes to that ecosystem, be it white rhinos or black rhinos. They, by removing these mega herbivores, you radically alter the foliage that is there, and it continues to grow, and it becomes, I would say, stale or anything like that. But you'll begin to find that, you'll get one particular type of plant or bush beginning to dominate in a particular area. And by that domination, then you see a reduction in the biodiversity of the insects. And so if you see a reduction in types of insects, then types of small animals, types of amphibians all are reduced. Then if you get those prey species are reduced, then you're going to see a reduction in the number of different types of predator. So you see this collapse of an ecosystem into a much smaller kind of group of animals that might exist in a particular area.
Can you share with our listeners just how dire the poaching situation is with rhinos right now?
Sure. Up until about 2016, the numbers were just going up and up and up and up. It got to about, I think at one point, there were 3 animals being poached a day. Then COVID came along and it dropped right down because it was very difficult to move around Southern Africa. Last year, I believe there was something like 220 animals poached. This year, up until about the beginning of July, August, already there had been more than 230 animals poached. So it went up, it's dropped, and then now the numbers are starting to go back up again as the world has opened up. Numbers of animals in the Kruger National Park, and it's a piece of land the size of Israel, over 11 years, the population declined by 70% due to poaching alone. Yeah, animals, they obviously, rhinos, as an adult, they don't have much in the way of predators, but as babies, you've got hyena, you've got lion, you've got strong big male leopards, all are quite capable of killing a baby rhino. But that's, if you like, that's the ongoing natural rate of predation. It's when, you know, man comes along with high-powered rifles and things like that, then the rates have just started to go back up again. So yeah, no, it is, we thought he had it under control. No, I don't think the poaching is under control at all. I think it's going to go up again unless we got some significant interventions. We could even see the vet numbers going up, because there are those sick individuals in the world who would want to be the owner of the last rhino horn in the world.
If our listeners want to support the project, have ideas, I know you've mentioned you've crowdsourced a lot of this, reaching out to people around the world, which I think is so incredible to have sort of like a international effort around this. What is the best way to support the project, to reach out to you?
I think the best way at the moment is to go to our website, which is rhizotope.org. Don't need www in front of it at all. It's just rhizotope.org. And there are various different ways people can get involved. Obviously, the one important thing is the donation of money. There is other ways. If you're a corporate, then you can go to click through to universities. University Foundation, which is, there's one in the US, there's one in the UK, there's one in Australia. But if there are corporates who want to give, then there is the appropriate documentation which can be produced for the corporations for those types of donations. But if an individual wants to go through the PayPal portal, then please do so.
Earlier you mentioned that rhinos have different personalities. Do you have a favorite rhino you've met?
Oh, I think there's a rhino, he was in the Eastern Cape, he's been moved to another game farm as a part of a sort of genetics, one called Denver, and he and another one called Igor were the two rhinos we started. This is where our journey started, where we did some initial work putting stable isotopes into the horns to see if there was movement of material out of the horn. And somehow he's got a kind of quiet nature. He always looked after his younger sisters and things like that. He's grown into be quite a handsome lad now. And it just sort of tickles me that we have that one called Denver. Is if you look at a picture of him from right in front, this rhino hasn't missed a meal in his life, because he's almost a nice perfect circle, which is a good healthy shape for a good male rhino.
We've been asking everyone this season their favorite binge watch show.
What program have I binge watched? It was The Gentleman, but then there was one or two other definitely. And that was the last one, which kind of I thoroughly enjoyed. So kind of gives you the background of where I've come from, to, if you understand that sort of sense of humor.
Well, we appreciate everything you're doing with the Rhizotope Project, and Really appreciate you coming to talk about it. And hopefully we can help share the word.
Please do.
Well, that was a really cool conversation. I'm glad James shared how listeners can get involved with the Ricetope Project.
Yes, absolutely. If you're not following them on social media, go for it. TikTok. Their website is full of really great information as well. So definitely follow up if you're interested in getting involved. Have you watched The Gentleman that he mentioned?
No, I haven't watched that yet. Have you?
No, it's great. I'm getting new things to watch, but I feel like I'm behind. I need one of our guests to say they've watched Emily in Paris.
Which I am right now, and I'm loving this season. As always.
I just finished watching it. Yes.
Oh, you finished the whole thing? I haven't finished it yet.
I did. I'm not gonna spoil the ending, but it's interesting. There could be a seismic shift happening.
Oh, well, I just saw it got renewed for season 5, so I'm here for that.
Excellent. Well, James, amazing conversation. We will have to have him back at some point to give us an update once they get further along in this project and hear how things are going. Just absolutely incredible, incredible work and use of nuclear.
Yeah. And any listeners, if you guys get involved with the Ricetope Project or any other interesting conservation efforts, we'd love to know. So, you know, leave a message or follow us on socials and let us know. Yeah, we're interested to see how you guys engage with this episode. And if you enjoyed the show, support the podcast by subscribing on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to leave a comment and let us know your thoughts on the episode. Thanks for listening.